Hello and welcome to Britstrapped. This week Nick's away, so we've got an interview with George Palmer of Sendal. I know you're going to find it interesting, so without further ado, here we go. Hi there, George.
Hi.
How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you. Yeah.
Good. It's been a long time since I've seen you at Microconf.
Yeah, it's been a few months. The British weather has turned cold.
Although we're possibly expecting a heatwave on Halloween, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's good news.
Somebody was telling me we're going to have something like 20 degrees, so that would be nice. But anyway, before we get into it, do you want to just give us a bit of background about yourself and about Sendal, for those people that haven't heard about it? What is Sendal?
Yeah, so my name's George Palmer, and I run a company called Sendal. And Sendal is a e-commerce platform that specializes in digital goods. So if you want to sell a ebook, a fitness video, wedding dress pattern, a GPS route to the outback, then you need a bit of software to plug into your website and deliver the files automatically when somebody buys it. Now, you can, of course, do this manually, you know, and wait for a bit of money through PayPal and email out the file, but
yeah,
you're selling more than two or three a day, that quite quickly becomes laborious. Absolutely. So that's what a digital delivery platform does, and that's what we are.
Excellent. That sounds great. So how long have you been going?
Well, we were five this month, actually, 5 years.
Congratulations.
So, yeah, it's a bit of a significant boundary, really, and it's great to have come so far, because for me it was just a weekend and evening project that you know, I saw a need for and worked on and hoped to get a few customers, and then a few customers turned to a few more, and
yeah,
me working weekends and evenings turned to one day a week, and then 2 days a week, and then 3 days a week, and then full time.
So it's a real organic sort of growth then?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's been interesting from a personal point of view as well, because in those very early days, 98-99% of what I did was the actual programming. Now there's a small team of four of us, and, you know, I probably only do the programming about 30 to 50% of the time, and really the plan is to drop that right down to zero and hand over to everybody else.
Yeah.
So I can focus more on running and growing the business.
Yeah, sure.
So it's been really interesting, because, you know, when you start out with a business and you start out with this one skill that kind of gets you going, and as you move on, you need to develop all these different skills that you just didn't really have before. So I picked up design and SEO.
Right.
You know, copywriting, various other things over the years, and yeah, I mean, it's been great from that point of view. If you're learning and you like exploring new areas, which I do.
Yeah, absolutely. So, what did you do before Sendal?
So I actually started out after university at IBM, and I kind of got a bit frustrated with the bureaucracy and the politics of a large company. And I think the critical thing for me was I kind of saw the interest in jobs, and they were dead man's shoes. You know, you were going to get them maybe if you were 60, if you were lucky.
Yeah.
You know, if you'd worked your way up the ladder enough. And I just thought, I don't really want to be in the office when I'm 60. I want to be in a family or something, you know.
Absolutely, yeah.
And of course, you never make any money working for anybody else. So I'm not really bothered by the money. It doesn't, you know, it's not something I go after. For me, it was all about the freedom. So, yeah. So I did a few years there, and came up to London and worked for a startup that went bust. And then became a freelancer, and freelanced for a couple of years. And then I saw this, and, you know, one of the great things about freelancing is when you finish one gig and you're looking for your next one, you can say, well, actually, I only work 4 days a week.
Yeah.
And they don't tend to question it. Whereas if you're applying for a job, they tend to say, well, the job's 5 days a week.
So yeah.
Work 5 days a week or not do it at all.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that leap from salaried employee to freelancer is quite liberating, isn't it?
It is, especially like I found I really liked the fact that you could go in and, you know, you'd learn a lot. You'd get set up in the first month, and then you'd have a, you know, really enjoy a couple of months learning the project. And if after that you didn't want to continue, you didn't have to. You know, it's why 3 months is up, you're perfectly entitled to walk away.
Mm.
Whereas in a full-time job, I sort of felt this sort of endlessness sort of 4 years in front of me, and there's no end to it, really.
That's right, climbing the greasy pole.
Yeah, so I much preferred contracting to being a full-time employee.
Yeah.
That's at the very end of my contracting career. I did work for one company that I really, really liked, and I probably would have gone full-time there if I hadn't got sent out grant at that point. So,
oh, right, that's interesting.
But yeah, it took me several years to get somebody like that.
So. Yeah, sure. And so when you went freelancing, did you have the idea from the start that you were going to try and start a product and move towards product revenue rather than freelancing?
No, I mean, it was around that time I was reading The 4-Hour Workweek, which is a book that polarizes a lot of people, but I really enjoyed it, and I thought the high-level concepts in there are absolutely spot on. And the one that really stood out for me is when you're freelancing or just doing a normal job, you're just trading your time for money. And, you know, there's only so much you can or want to work, and therefore there's a limit to the amount of money that you can make.
Yeah.
And if you decide to get away or have an extended break, you're not making any money.
Yeah.
So I really like this idea of passive income. And I was looking at sort of the classic first thing of writing an ebook or something along those lines. And as I was researching that, I came across the digital delivery systems, and I was just appalled at the state of the market, really. So I was like, I can do better than this.
Right.
And saw that as the opportunity. And so I then sort of set about, well, you know, can I create a digital delivery system whilst working full time? You know, is this feasible? Can this be done? And then tested, you know, before I actually went down the step of writing the code, I actually tested that I could get sufficient demand by creating a like a landing page with a, so it looked like we actually had a solution before we did.
Yeah.
And then we just tested how many people click the buy button to see what kind of conversion we would get.
And how did you handle that? Did you sort of, when they click the buy button, did you say, oh, thank you, but sorry, it's not available? Or how did you handle that disappointment that they might have?
Yeah. We just had an email box. Just type your email in here and we'll let you know when we launch.
Right, okay, yeah.
And we worded it to say, like, we're really close. And, you know, you don't just put a page up and thousands of people turn up at it. We just bought £100 worth of Google AdWords and just saw what conversion we got on that. And I knew if I could get, if it got 2.5% and it was doing extremely well, if I get one above 1%, that was my cutoff. That's the point at which I decided I would do it.
So what, 1% conversions, 1% sign-ups on the site?
Yeah, 1% of people that visited the page tried to sign up.
Right.
So, and we got above 1%, so I was like, right, this is a goer. And and then at that point, sort of outsourced the design of the site and got coding myself.
Yeah. So how did you know then in those early days? So AdWords, I guess it was a bit cheaper back then. But even so, how did you know which keywords to target?
I didn't. Right. is this your answer? I just used the keyword tool from memory and typed in a few phrases that I knew. A really good trick actually is if you look at your competitors and look at their meta tags. They've done half the work already.
Yeah, sure.
So I just nicked those, put them into keyword tool, got a few new suggestions, and I only choose 4 or 5 because it didn't need to be super accurate or super efficient. It was just £100 to test whether the business was viable or not.
Yeah.
And what you can actually do now is, talking to a guy a couple of months ago and I recommended this to him, is there's lots of places these days that do like free $100 AdWords vouchers if you sign up for X.
Yeah.
You know, and that can be free. So you can even get the credit to do the test for your site for free if you're a bit smart about it.
Yeah,
so,
sure.
So it's not a, you know, for me it was just about £100 to validate an idea that I really wanted to do, and I was quite happy to pay that money.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. I must admit, I've tried to do that sort of thing in the past, and I've always struggled with the keyword finding thing. But that's a really good idea about looking at the competitors. Were there many competitors out there when you started?
Yeah, so there was a group of about five or six. And then it seems as I was having that idea, there were another five or six also having the same idea around the same time. So they weren't there when I did my initial research, but as the sort of first year went on, they all sort of popped up. And a lot of them had been there before me. I just hadn't managed to find them because they were so new.
So there's
sort of competitors really fall into two camps for us. There's the guys that have been around from like 2000 or something. And then there's some more modern ones that have popped up in the last 5 years. But really, I wouldn't say we've seen any new competitors in the last 2 or 3 years. It seems to be just existing people like moving on their product.
Yeah. Cool. I saw a lot of really good feedback on Sendout when I did a quick search a little while ago. And I heard Rob Walling as well on Startups the Rest of Us. He was talking about it in very glowing terms.
Yeah, he was, which is very nice.
That was really, really good. So it occurred to me, how do you actually get the message out there? How do you approach the marketing these days?
Yes, the way I did it back then was sort of fell a bit into the classic trap of built this product, and it was the minimal viable product. I was very strict on that because I didn't want to invest more time and money than I needed to. So we didn't have a way to charge customers at the end of the month or anything like that. You know, it was just, it just did the absolute minimum it needed to do. And of course, we then launched, and I was like, right, great, where are all the customers? where are they going to come from?
Yeah.
So the way I found my first customers was I scoured Twitter for people complaining of my competitors. And I just reached out and said, hey, look, we're new, but you might like to check us out.
Right.
And the thing about the first 10 or so customers from that in the first month, and that kind of started a bit of a snowball. So there's a guy in Sweden and a guy in South Korea, and they both obviously mentioned this system to everybody that they they saw, or everybody in the same sector.
Fantastic.
And so we had a lot of our early customers were in those two countries. And then it obviously expanded on, and we have customers all over the world now. But the first 10 customers or so were very manual and very slow via Twitter. And I did then try and automate it. So that each morning I'd get an email with tweets that might match my criteria and I could reach out to them manually. But there were a few problems with that. A lot of people were just using Twitter as a way to spam their products for sale. So whenever I searched for a competitor, it would bring up loads of products that were for sale.
Right.
And so there would literally be hundreds and hundreds of emails every day. So hundreds and hundreds of tweets every day.
Mm.
So I'd kind of filtered it down a little bit so I could get a shortlist, and then Twitter changed its API and the way you could access it and so on, so I actually then couldn't do what I used to do.
Oh, right.
So it kind of died a little bit of a death, but it still, you know, it got the first 10 or so customers in, which was what we needed to get the ball rolling.
Yeah, sure. And so what do you do these days for marketing? Do you do sort of any copywriting, that sort of stuff, content marketing?
Yeah, I mean, to be completely honest, marketing's probably the thing that we're worst at. Our best marketing channel has been, by far and away, our customers recommending our service to their friends.
Yeah.
So we get a really high referred customer rate. And I think the reason we do that is, the reason we get that is a couple of reasons. Firstly, we focus on having a really clean and usable user interface. So I think a lot of, especially funded startups, they focus so much on having like a really cool or a really sort of cutting edge UI design.
Mm.
And half the time they're just not usable. it just drives me insane. I was trying to reset a password on Shopify the other day, and I couldn't for the life of me find the forgot password that link.
Right.
And it was actually a question mark in the password field, like one of those ones to the right-hand side that was grey. And I was like, that'll be cool in a few years' time when everybody's used to that analogy.
Yeah.
Nobody's used to it right now.
Yeah.
So we try not to do anything too cutting edge that's just cool for the sake of it. We'll only do stuff if it's really good, usable design. So it needs to be usable first, and it needs to be quick first before you worry about how it's styled.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing that makes, you know, we make it just ridiculously easy for people to get set up, which really helps. The second thing is we do really great support. So if you email in to send out, like, the absolute longest you'll ever wait for a reply is 24 hours.
Right.
Average is well below 6, and you'll often get a reply within an hour.
Fantastic.
So it only takes longer if it has to get escalated to a second or third line.
Yeah.
So, and we're really, you know, we provide really great help articles with videos that walk people through everything step by step. So if you've never actually uploaded a file to the internet and sold it before, then it's still really simple to get going.
Yeah.
So, and we don't try and lie to customers or anything like that. There's so many stupid things that people do, or trying, like, you know, oh, it's coming soon, and a year later you're still waiting for it. You know? Yeah. If we're not going to do it, or it's not on the immediate plan, then we'll say.
Right.
If it's something that's in the next two or three things that we're tackling, then we'll say, yeah, it's around the cards.
Yeah.
And so I think as a result, like, you know, we just have a really easy to use system, and we have a great customer support. And then the third thing is we're really reliable. So a lot of certainly the older generation of digital delivery systems had a lot of reliability problems, like they go offline for a couple of hours at a time. And you just can't, you know, you're losing sales if that happens.
Yeah, sure. So your customers then, I think you mentioned knitting patterns and the like. So are they, do you have a real range of sort of technical ability, so to speak, or are they generally, because it's such a simple system to use, that's why they choose you, because they're not that computer literate or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, we have a complete range. So we have people selling books on computer programming, which is it's technically going to get.
Yeah.
And then we have people, what we call the creative arts, so like knitting and crochet. And, you know, they're often in those women in 50s and 60s. They've been doing it all their life, and they're like a world expert on it.
Right. But
turning on a computer is it's not something they do a lot. So it's with them, you know, it's the support we try and tailor it a little more to how capable they are. Interestingly, with smartphones, we've noticed a lot now. People will actually, they'll just video their computer screen and send it to us. Give a running commentary, and they're like, oh, I'm clicking this and it's not working, or I'm trying to do this and it's not working, or I try to delete one of my products, but I made a mistake and delete the wrong one, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, we'll try and tailor how we do support and the level at which we'll give that support to who it is. So if they've got a programming book, we might say, oh, if you wanted to automate that, you could use our API. There's no way we're going to mention that to somebody that's like knitting or crochet patterns.
Sure, yeah, cool. And you mentioned your support. What kind of setup have you got? You talked about different levels. Do you have a dedicated support team, or is it just one of the four of you that works on the product?
Yeah, so we have a dedicated guy called Paul who we purposely hired in the States because that's where the majority of our customers are nowadays. So he's on the same time zone as them, which really helps.
Yeah.
And he can do 80 to 90% of the tickets. And then either myself or the other developer, Andrew, will be on call that week for third line ticket support. And a lot of the time it's just Paul clarifying a series of conditions. So if they have option A, B, and C turned on, and that's selling via mobile, and they want to do a redirect after payment, and, you know, you just get really obscure conditions that people do, and you have to actually look in the code to see what should happen. So a lot of it's that, and then occasionally it's bug reports. We don't get too many of those, fortunately. And then we actually deal with feature requests separately. We meet once a week and go through everything that's been requested and look at our current priority list and tend to adjust based on what's coming in, really.
Yeah, sure. So was there a tipping point? So you're now, I think it was 4 employees, wasn't it? But when you when you were going, obviously it was just yourself, and then you eventually went full time. Was there a tipping point when you realised that you need to get people involved as well as you?
Yeah, there was a really clear tipping point. I realised I was doing about 3 hours of support a day.
Right.
And it was just me at this point, so I was leaving about 5 hours for programming, and the rate at which I was getting new stuff out the door was getting a lot lower. So I was like, well, I'm not moving as fast as I used to, and I don't like that. And I'm spending a lot of my time answering simple questions via support, which is not a very effective use of my time either. So at that point, I decided to take somebody on to handle support. And what I hadn't really thought through in my naivety is that you then have to train that person up in support. So you get busier in the short term to get less busy in the long term. Mm. So, you know, and then once you go from just being a one-band man to actually, you know, having employees, it kind of changes the nature of how you run the company, and everything that's been in your head starts to need to get documented and put into processes and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know, the last year when we've taken on a few people, well, it was the end of last year actually, it's really changed the way I've had to run the company and how we've had to do things. But it's great that, you know, I had a week off the other week and came back and the latest new features had been developed and the support queue was empty. And I was like, oh, this is the value of having employees.
Fantastic, yeah, that sounds amazing. And when you took on that the first person, was that kind of a full-time employee, or was it through Odesk or something like that?
Yeah, so I mean, we had originally, before Paul, who is the current support person in full-time, we had experimented with somebody part-time on Odesk, but you know, I wanted to build a company for the future, for the long term, and hiring somebody up at Odesk wasn't really a solution for that. You know, you could give them the 20 most asked questions and give them a scripted answer, but I wasn't overly happy with the quality, and it just didn't seem like I was setting up a relationship for the long term.
Yeah, sure.
So in a higher pool, and still really to this day, the support tickets that we get are not, you know, there's not enough for him to be doing the job full time. So we're spending the rest of the time investing in new documentation and videos, which in turn decreases the number of tickets.
Yeah.
So, we measure two metrics each month, and we're really strict about what we measure, because we don't want to measure more metrics than are important and that actually matter. Because, you know, if you go into Google Analytics, there's hundreds of things there you could look at each month, but yeah, actually there's only a very few of those that are actually important and therefore need to be measured.
Yeah.
So when it comes to support, we measure the absolute number of tickets, which tends to go up each month because we get more customers. But then we also measure the number of tickets per customer. And that's really our really important metric, because it enables us to see if all this investment in better user interface in the app around confusing bits, better documentation, support videos, if our number of tickets per customer is going down, which it has every month for like the last year since we've started measuring it, then we know we're actually doing a really good job and people are having less problems using the system than they used to. So, so on a support point of view, at the moment, that's what we use the spare capacity for, but there'll come a point where even with all that work, Paul will be full time and then we'll have to bring on a second person for support.
Yeah, sure. So did you start out with the goal of being just a one person company, or did you always plan on building something with employees and relationships?
That's a good question. I guess I started out really wanting to have a passive income, and within a year, it came very obvious that was not going to happen. Mm. One of the main reasons for that is the way people buy e-commerce software is you can have the best support, you can have the best design, but if you've not got that one feature that they need, then they won't use your software.
Yeah.
So for the first 4 years of Sendell's 5-year history, we were playing feature catch up with our competitors that had been around for a lot longer than us.
Right.
And so, you know, it became very apparent to me in that period that really I wasn't going to get a passive income out of this. It was going to be a full-time job. But it was a full-time job that I wanted to do way, way more than any other full-time job. Yeah. So it was my own company. And, you know, during the really hard times when there was just me and I didn't really have enough to have a support person full-time, and I was working, you know, 50, 60 hours a week and then doing weekend work as well to clear the support queue.
Yeah.
You know, at times like that, you start to question your judgment. But
can you imagine? Yeah, yeah.
But then, you know, you get an employee and things start to get better as, you know, you do. So I now just work, you know, fairly standard 9 to 5 each day.
Mm.
So,
so things have changed a bit over time then. You started out with wanting the passive income and now you're kind of building the company for the future.
Yeah, you know, we say this very publicly on our site about being a bootstrap company and we want to be in for the long term. One of the things that drives me insane is you start using these really nice services on the internet and then they get bought out by somebody and shut down.
Yeah, yeah.
So like Posterous was one of those. What was another one that I was using recently? It just drives me mad because then you've got to get your data out and migrate it.
Yeah, it's a real pain, isn't it?
Yeah. And so we do get people that email, you know, we get a few of these a month that email into support and say, can you tell me a bit about your company? I don't want to sign up and have to move all my stuff in a year's time. So, no, we're in it for the long term. And, you know, I wanted to build a company that would give me the lifestyle that I wanted to, really.
Yeah. So you mentioned at the beginning that these days you don't get a chance to do too much programming. How do you feel about that? Obviously, that was the driving force at the start. How do you feel about your working day now and what does it look like?
Yeah, it's a bit bittersweet, really. I love the programming and I have the years, but I'm not a true techie. I don't like playing with new technology just for the sake of it. I mean, I do enjoy that, but what's always been my interest is what I can do with the technology.
Yeah.
So with Sendal, you know, a lot of the pleasure has been people writing in and saying, just wanted to thank you so much for everything you do. And then they've got a bit of a life story and, you know, Sendal has enabled them to work at home and look after their disabled child whilst producing a passive income.
Wow, yeah.
You know, or, I mean, we get some great quotes. There's one guy said, I've just changed to Sendal and I feel I've like walked out of McDonald's and into a fine steakhouse.
Fantastic.
I was like, love it. So, you know, that for me is where a lot of the pleasures come. I'll be completely honest, I can't. At the moment, I still get sucked into the code because I really do enjoy it. And there's that little bit of perfection in me that just wants everything to be spun. But we do from a purely sort of technical point of view, we are extremely careful about changes that we make and push live on the site, because if we just have 2 minutes of downtime or 2 minutes of bugs that get released, then that's customers somewhere in the world that are unable to sell as a result of us having screwed up. So it's not like, you know, even a help desk software, which are quite difficult because there's always people using them. If they're down for a few minutes, it's not the end of the world. People just can't access their support queue.
Yeah.
With the e-commerce software, people can't sell. Mm. And if you're, you know, we have some really big customers that turn over several $1 million a month. And
wow,
the cost of that downtime to them is like, it's tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah.
So, I mean, my aim is to really be completely out of it by the end of the year, which gives me, looking at the date, just less than 2 months.
Yes, it's going quickly, yeah.
Yeah, it's going
quickly. So in order to get the reliability and the quality in your software, what kind of testing do you do? Do you have sort of an automated test suite? Do you have a tester dedicated to testing, or how do you do it?
Yeah, so we have an automated test suite, but, you know, I have some perhaps slightly controversial views on testing. That is, your automated test suite is only as good as your tests, and you could spend months and months writing an infinite amount of tests and you'll still get bugs that get through.
Yeah.
So the way I've always developed and the way, you know, we develop it, send out, is comprehension is more important than testing. So what I mean by that is it's more important that you understand fully the implications of the changes that you're making than it is that the tests pass.
Right.
So let's take like the two cases. So let's say you're going like a rely on the test approach. You go in, you make a change, you're like, I'm not 100% sure, but I'll just try this and all the tests have passed. Great, I must be right.
Yeah, sure.
You know, that's one philosophy.
Yeah.
Whereas I will be like, okay, so we're changing the orders to support gifting. So that's something we've just done last month. You can now gift an order to somebody. And so when we did that, we sat and thought through the implications of every change that we wanted to make. So when you do a gift order, which emails should go where? Which ones should go to the person that pays and which ones should go to the person that had been gifted the item? And you sort of have to follow every little branch through and be really satisfied in your brain that like all the logic is complete.
Yeah.
And I find once you do that, and you have full comprehension. So if you're new to a project, you'll obviously need to go in and learn how the area works first.
Mm.
I find if you do that and you hire experienced developers that have got, you know, 5+ years or 2+ years and really shit hot, then the amount of bugs that you'll get naturally is extremely, extremely low.
Mm.
The other thing that we do is we always test manually in the browser the feature as it's been added, you know, and then with that little option turned off. So on send out, you can turn gifting on and off. So when we added gifting, we made sure we tested it with gifting, and then at the very end, we sanity tested it without it off.
Right.
To make sure we'd, you know, killed all cases.
Yeah. It's interesting that you say actually about people relying on test passing to validate their code without actually thinking it through. That's really important. I've had some experience with developers on Odesk where that's precisely how they qualify the fact that they've done a good job is, you know, it tested okay, but the comprehension wasn't there, so it was full of bugs, just bugs that they didn't actually understand, you know.
Exactly, and I've worked with some really, really good developers in the UK when I was freelancing, and it would work, and they're like, well, all the tests pass, it works, and you'd fire up in the browser, and it didn't work at all.
Yeah.
You're like, you haven't even tested it in a browser. Like,
yeah.
Do you get in a car where an engine and a steering wheel have been explicitly tested extremely well individually as components in a factory, but never in a car together? It's like, no, not in a million years would you. Absolutely. And I don't see why it's any different with a web app, to be honest with you.
Yeah, you're right. It's all levels of confidence, isn't it? So having a test suite gives you a certain level of confidence, but not a complete level of confidence.
Yeah, and for me, the test suite is there to be run at the end when you think everything's done to sanity check that you haven't forgotten anything.
Yeah, sure.
But as I say, like, you know, do you perhaps have slightly controversial views on testing?
we had Nick and I had a chat about this last time, actually, and I think I agree completely with what you just said. And in the freelance world, I always find that testing tends to be the thing that gets kicked out the window first because the client's banging on your door saying they need the project done, you know. Mm. So, yeah, it's a difficult area. But anyway, so what does the future hold? How far in advance do you plan for Sendout?
Oh, about a month.
Right.
Not far at all. I mean, I remember hearing this great quote from one of the Google execs saying the furthest we think ahead is 6 months because there's no point trying to plan further than that. It just doesn't work. You know, things change too much. So we really know what we're doing for the next month. We discuss it in the monthly meeting. And we do have, you know, in our Trello board for development, the next 4 or 5 items are kind of lined up in the order that we want to do them. But that does kind of chop and change. So when, for example, Stripe was launched, you know, one or two people emailed in for Stripe and were like, okay, yeah, we'll put it on the backlog.
Right.
And then, you know, over the next month, about 20 people, or I don't know, 50 or 100, however many emailed in about Stripe. And suddenly we're like, oh, this is going to be quite a big thing, you know.
Yeah,
so we bumped it right up and got straight on it. So we generally do have an order in which we see, you know, across our whole customer base, what is the next most important thing. But we do, every month, we do chop and change, and we do use requests from customers, customer feature requests. That is our primary driver of what we work on next.
Right. Cool. Excellent. Okay. Well, thanks very much for your time today. I think that's really interesting. I hope people get a lot out of it. I'm sure they will. So how can people find out more about you and get in contact, etc.?
Yeah, so thanks to Posterous, I don't have a blog anymore.
Oh, no.
But if they wanted to contact me on Twitter, my username is Giorgio_1999. So that's GEORGIO_1999. Or alternatively, if you're interested in Sendowl, you can go to sendowl.com, which is sendowl.com.
Excellent. That's great. Well, thanks very much again for your time, and hopefully we'll catch up soon for a beer.
Thank you, mine. It's been a pleasure.
Cheers, George.